This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
North Portland Library on 512 North Killingsworth Street. The time is 10:59, coming up at 11 o'clock. It's The Food Show with your hosts, Kate Welch and Chris Siegel.
Wisdom of the Elders is committed to Native American cultural sustainability, multimedia education, and race conciliation. It especially seeks to correct misconceptions and prejudice, to bring health and wellness to Native people, and demonstrate how Indian culture has and is continuing to enrich our worlds. An evening with Wisdom of the Elders, its second annual gala, is planned for Friday, June 21st, at 6:30 p.m. in the Rose Ballroom of the Ainsworth Event Center in Southwest Portland. The featured guest and keynote speaker will be Deanna D. Dart, Ph.D., Curator of Native American Art at the Portland Art Museum. Cedar Rose will perform a collaborative musical effort that focuses on traditional and contemporary Native American sounds formed by Karen Kitchen and Nico Wind. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the third annual 2013 Closer Electronic Music Festival, which starts June 20th. Closer PDX is hosting this cutting-edge electronic music and dance festival with an unparalleled selection of local and regional talent and labels. The Closer Electronic Music Festival is being held on the inner sides of East and West Portland at many different venues. From the kickoff at Crush on June 20th to the Closer at Selwood Riverfront on June 23rd, there will be more than 50 performers and special guests. More information and tickets for this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at our carbon-neutral Eco Brew Pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com.
And thanks for tuning into the KBOO Food Show. This is our theme song that is by Brian QTN, and I just want you all to know that he's playing at the People's Farmers Market today from 2 to 4 p.m., and I'm Kate Welch.
And I'm Chris Siegel.
And today on The Food Show, we're going to start with an interview Kate and I had with Barbara Damrosch. She recently wrote The Four Seasons Farm Gardener's Cookbook with her partner Elliot Coleman, another author and farmer. In the middle of the show, we'll have a conversation with Nolan Kalish and Molly Sherman of Farm School. We talk about their recent collaboration called The Old Apple Tree Project. And to close, we will have a panel discussion featuring market managers from Portland area farmers markets. But first, we have some announcements from Kate.
Yeah, I just wanted to let you all know that we have 1 hour a month here on the KBOO Food Show, on the KBOO airwaves for the food show. And we try to keep some current issues ongoing, but it's probably impossible to do it all 1 month. But I just wanted to point out a few things to you. One thing, Barbara Bernstein on her program Locus Focus on Monday, she interviewed Julia DeGraw from Food and Water Watch. Julia is the Northwest organizer for Food and Water Watch, and they talked about GMO salmon. And I think it was important information. And if you didn't hear it, I urge you all to go to the kboo.fm website and search for locus focus 6, 17, 13. And beyond that, there's the ongoing farm bill, which is currently being discussed in Congress. There's lots of news on that. Do a Google search for farm bill news. And here we have something coming up tomorrow, Thursday, June 20th. The event begins at noon in Salem on the Capitol steps. Oregonians stand up for Oregon farmers against GMO. This Thursday, a rally will be held on the front steps of the Capitol in Salem to formally present the petition Stop GMO in Oregon to Governor John Kitzhaber. The petition includes three goals. One, call for an immediate moratorium on field testing of any GMO crop in Oregon. Two, reaffirm the 110-year-old mission of the Oregon State Land Grant University to conduct practical agricultural research and offer it for free to farmers. And three, seek legal remedy from Monsanto for economic damages to Oregon due to its proprietary GMO seed. So, and we go on a little bit, but if you want to be there, that's on the front steps of the Salem Capitol tomorrow at noon. Now, skipping along here, we're going to go on to one of the solutions sides of our food stories. And this story is of a lifetime of innovative organic farming. Barbara Damrosch and Elliot Coleman have written a book about gardening and cooking, titled The Four-Season Farm Gardener's Cookbook. Barbara Damrosch and Elliot Coleman farm on the coast of Maine. She writes a weekly column for the Washington Post called A Cook's Garden. She joined us in a KABU studio for the following piece. Welcome to KABU, Barbara.
Well, thank you so much.
You've just released a new book that you wrote with Elliot Coleman. It's The Four-Season Farm Gardener's Cookbook. Can you talk about your book?
Sure. Well, Elliot's my husband, and we wrote it together, but I did all of the cooking part. The growing part was a collaboration.
I was going to say, you have many, many, many years of horticultural experience and gardening experience, and you started this garden, the Four Season Farm, 20 years ago?
No. Elliot started it in 1968.
Oh, you only joined it 20 years
ago.
We
met about 22 years ago.
Okay.
We got married almost immediately.
So tell us about the evolution of the garden and the book and the farm, everything.
Well, the farm is a wonderful story. He was married to his first wife, Susan, at that point. And he'd been a semi-pro adventurer. He was a whitewater kayaker and rock climber and hockey player. You name it, he did it. And he read a book by Helen and Scott Nearing, Living the Good Life, and he got interested in organic farming. And to him, that was the next adventure. You know, a mountain climber doesn't look for the easy route. They look for the interesting route. And to him, that's what organic agriculture was. So he and Susan hacked this place out of the wilderness. It was just a spruce fir forest, very poor soil, sandy, acid soil. And they created the soil and became really quite famous for their tiny farm. It just had wonderful results.
How did they get so famous? Because I looked at the farm on Google Maps, and it's really out there. It's far down East Maine.
The Wall Street Journal wrote an article about them, and then 2 years later came back and wrote another article about them. The hippie farm that actually worked.
Oh, because
everybody was doing that and following the Nearings.
Elliot
and Susan actually bought land from Helen and Scott, so it was part of their acreage. And so with some interruptions for divorce and things like that and running other farms, you know, including one on a mountaintop in Vermont at a school.
What farm was that?
Well, it was called the Mountain School in Verscher, Vermont.
Okay.
And that was one reason why he got into the four-season farming thing, because here you are a teacher, and it was a place where kids spent half a year and took regular subjects, but also grew all their own food and learned all sorts of wilderness skills and things like that. So he was always trying to get the school year involved in gardening. And if you're in Zone 3, Vermont, it's hard to do. So he started putting greenhouses inside of hoop houses, things like that. He'd actually started a little bit of that when he ran a farm briefly in Topsfield, Mass., a research farm. And he'd led farm tours for American farmers to show how Europe had something in between the gardener and the huge industrial farm. They still had small farms, and they had a lot of techniques and skills and equipment that we could apply. And the whole goal has been to make food growing more efficient. The thing that they always tell you, well, small-scale organic farming can't feed the world. The only thing stopping it from feeding the world quite easily is efficiency. And so he's been working on technologies and techniques to make it easier. So he started writing books about it. He's written, this is his fourth book, my third, and the books have been very widely received. And so Elliot's really a hero to small farmers. And I was a college teacher. We both were teachers, actually, at the college level in literature. He taught Spanish and sort of adventure sports. But I wandered out because I wanted to work on an organic farm and grow my own food. And I did that in Connecticut. I had a landscape design business to put my son through college. And then I wound up meeting Elliot in Helen Deering's greenhouse. He was tying up her tomato plants. It could not have been more appropriate or romantic. And that was in 1991, and we've been farming together ever since. And so we've attracted a lot of attention. And the farm is, Elliot's a very tidy farmer. It's very aesthetic. But as I always tell people, it's because the form follows the function. It's beautiful because it's well done. You know, the rows are straight. There aren't very many weeds. And that's not because we want to make it look pretty. It's because we want the plants to grow better and yield better. Mm-hmm. So it's all part of the same thing.
And now you've come to the cookbook portion. Have you written a cookbook before?
No, but my publisher's been trying to get me to write one for, 25 years.
Have you always cooked?
Yes. I come from a cooking family, uh-huh. A cooking and gardening family. And I grew up in New York City, but we had a little country house. And my grandparents in Louisiana were wonderful food gardeners. And so we did that.
It's sort of a natural for you.
Yeah, we were always in the kitchen, all of us. And so someday I was inevitably going to write one. And we decided to combine the two things together because they go together.
They do go together. And I've been looking at your book, and everything I eat for the past week, I've picked up the cookbook and said, okay, what have they got to say about spinach? Mm-hmm. What about eggs? And there is not only what kinds of interesting recipes, but how to grow everything. Mm-hmm. Right down from the soil, composting soil.
And it makes so much sense. There's a lot of this, you know, at restaurants, at markets, this know your farmer. People want to have this perspective and want to know where their food came from and how it was produced. And I know for me, there's a lot of foods that I didn't like at one point, but then when I started growing them for myself, it was kind of a revelation. And so it just does. It makes so much sense to say, like, here's a food that maybe you don't like. Here's a recipe for it, but then here's also how to grow it. Give it a try, and then try cooking it yourself. And I think it just makes a world of difference.
Mm-hmm. It's great for families with young kids, too. The earlier you can introduce them to it, the better. And if they've grown it themselves, they're much more apt to try it. Take pride in it and find it interesting.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any favorite things that you like to cook? Are there seasons or are there specific crops that you get excited about?
Whatever I'm excited about is whatever is perfect at that moment. Like mm-hmm. right now, we're in asparagus season at home, as you are here. Uh-huh. And so everything's about asparagus, you know. But I have a lot of recipes that are sort of modular units. In other words, here's a recipe. How can you vary it according to what's in the garden? So something like a stir fry or a open-faced omelet or this quiche I make, which you don't have to have a pastry crust. You just shake kasha in a buttered pan and pour the batter in, the custardy filling, and whatever vegetables you have. And put it in the oven, and the buckwheat cooks along with the filling. And it's so simple. I mean, a lot of people, even people who are food lovers and like artisanal things, often just don't have the time. And so we've really made a point, both in gardening and cooking, to find shortcuts. I mean, on a farm, it's so that our farm can be more profitable, and we don't have to spend so much on labor. It goes for whoever you are. These days, you just cannot spend all your time in the kitchen. Well, I'd love to, but, you know, I'm a farmer too. So I have recipes that I can adapt to whatever the season is, whatever's in the garden, and doesn't take too much time.
And there are things that you cook that you keep handy, such as stock.
And you, yeah, I make and my you, own stocks, uh-huh. and that seems laborious, right? But this is a certain amount of chopping, or and it cooks for a long time. But you don't have to stand there watching it bubbling on the stove.
You just, and you also talk about in your book freezing.
Yeah, I freeze a few things. I freeze my stock. Yep, and freezing is simple. And so I always have chicken stock on hand and beef stock and vegetable stock. And I don't keep fish stock. I think even in a freezer, there's a certain shelf life to fish. But so if I make a fish stock, I try to use it right away.
Do you have any specific things about cooking stock that you think are important? I think that a lot of our listeners like to learn more about cooking.
Well, I mean, it just enriches things, and it gives a quick base for a soup, for instance.
You know, but when you're making stock, does it change? How do you ingredients
Well, there's
change?
Different ways to do it. If you want a really quick way, you just put your vegetables and your bones in there and cook them. If you want to roast some of that first, that gives it an added level of richness. So it's partly a question of time, what you want to put into it. And you want to simmer it slowly, and you don't have to watch it, as I say, but you have to be aware of it. And then strain everything out, put it in the jars. It's just, it's pretty simple. We like to buy or raise whole animals. And for one thing, we know how the meat is raised. We don't like to eat factory meat. A lot of people are vegetarians just because they don't like the way meat is raised in this country. But if you can find a local farmer, and for instance, we'll buy one whole lamb. We used to buy half or a whole pig. Now we have our own pigs. And we're going to be getting some beef cows, but I'll buy a quarter of a cow. And you get all different cuts in there. You get some steaks and chops and things like that, but you also get all kinds of odd bits. And the odd bits make wonderful stock. Or if you have a carcass, if you have a lamb bone or if you have a chicken skeleton, you put that in a pot and it flavors and enriches a stock. And that's the basis of your stock. And you put aromatic vegetables in, just ordinary garden things like celery and onions and carrots, leeks, and some, you know, bay leaves and peppercorns and herbs from the garden. And it's wonderful. It's a habit you get into.
What do you use the stock for besides? I mean, we all know about using stock in soup.
Right. And let's say I'm making a sauce. For instance, when I roast a chicken, I like to make what I call gooey chicken. Sometimes it's the first day and I'll make it out of the pan drippings. Sometimes it's the second day and I have the carcass. But if I really want it enriched, I'll take some stock I've already made and add it to this gravy, which is just boil down the bits of the pan, the wonderful bits that are so caramelized when you cook a piece of meat. And I add lemon and maybe some white wine and cream and I boil it down. I thicken it with lemon. You can thicken with lemon if you have enough fat content to the cream.
Thicken with lemon? I don't think I've heard of that.
I know.
Before.
Everybody tells you can't do it. You can never put cream and lemon together. Use the zest, whatever. And that's because if you use it with a light cream or milk, even worse, it will curdle. But if there's a high enough fat content, you can put as much lemon and cream as you want, and it thickens it.
I'm going to have to try that one.
So this is my gooey chicken, as we call it at home.
Gooey chicken.
Yeah. So I would add a pint of stock to that to enrich it, just to make more gravy. So that's one example.
I wanted to ask you about the animals on the farm, as you were talking about making stock and mm-hmm. getting a beef. Mm-hmm. And what animals do you have on the farm?
Well, we have a lot of chickens right now. We do sell eggs, so we have a lot of layers. And every year we raise some meat birds as well, and we have some of them in our freezer and some we give or sell to friends. Sometimes they'll have us grow them for them. We have, this year, 3 pigs. All our kids want half a pig each, so they come first.
Of course.
And that's it right now, but we're going to be getting some uh-huh. sheep and cows.
How many acres are you farming?
We're not very many. I'm really just an acre and a half with the vegetables.
Okay.
But we can gross $140,000 off of an acre and a half by a very carefully structured succession planting scheme mm-hmm. where a bed is never empty. We don't even put cover crops anymore. We use a lot of compost between crops instead. So there's always something growing on that land. And it's sort of expensive real estate because we've hacked it out of the woods. It's man-made soil, and some of it's undercover. We have unheated greenhouses for the most part. One is heated because we start seeds in it. One is heated because we wash and pack in it. And then there's one tomato house that's heated a little bit at the beginning of the season to get on the market with tomatoes early.
And when you talk about the market for your produce in Maine, how far do you have to travel for that market?
Well,
where does it go?
Well, we make a rule that we don't want to travel more than about 25, 30 miles. And the demand is enormous for what we produce.
Even year-round?
Oh, gosh, yes. Especially year-round.
I looked at it on the map. There's not very many people in Maine in the wintertime.
The population of Maine is just over 1 million people for the whole huge state.
Right.
But the people that are there really want it.
You know?
And there are not as many people growing in the winter, although we've influenced people.
I bet
more
you
and
have,
more people
absolutely.
Are. There's, all the little neighboring towns around us have a school greenhouse that have kids growing a few things in the school year, just like Elliot did in Vermont.
That's great.
Yeah. So we have a farm stand at the farm, and then we have a mobile farm stand called the Veggie Wagon, which is a little house, clapboard house that's pulled on a wagon and has all these shelves that open like a flower. And we tow it to market. So there's about three markets in neighboring towns we'll go to. We also sell wholesale to stores and restaurants year-round. So there's lots of outlets, but they're all really close by, really local, and everybody knows who we are.
I'm interested. So you've written books at this point. Elliot's written books. I'm curious, with this book in particular, who's the audience? Who are the people that you're trying to reach at this point? Since, you know, those books have been wildly successful and people have them on their shelves. Who's this book for exactly?
Well, that's an interesting question. It depends. Like, my garden primer was for the beginner, but I made it very complete. It's just a basic how to garden book. And so people who already know how to garden often look things up in it because I just tried to be really thorough. Elliot has some books he's written for the home gardener and some for the commercial gardener. So like his Winter Harvest Handbook or the New Organic Grower, those are for commercial small farmers. Yeah. Introduction to these things. His Four Season Harvest is for home gardeners. That's the garden year round in the home. This is for the beginner too, but I think that other people will use it as well because we have little tricks that even people who've been around the block with gardening and cooking haven't thought of.
I found that. I've been gardening since I was a little kid and cooking likewise, but I've scrolled through here and I found that it was a lot of interesting information.
Yeah, yeah. We tried to make it new.
Yeah, and I guess the concept is, it's kind of newer. The idea of when you get those gardening books, the farming books, it really is how to yield this certain vegetable. This vegetable, you're going for a certain flavor, a certain kind of size, color, but you're not necessarily thinking about the recipe that certain vegetable is going to be in.
No, you're thinking about whether your family will eat it or not.
Right, exactly.
Maybe they don't like rhubarb or whatever.
Mm-hmm. But here's how to grow it.
Here's how to grow
it. But then this is like the next step. It's like, here's how to grow it and
cook it. Because people garden less than they used to. Although that's changing. But people really did forget to cook for a while there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, definitely. And they still are, which is why we like to talk about cooking on the food show.
We really want to get people back in the kitchen. You know, everybody has jobs. I understand what it's like. That's why I tried to make these simple and mostly quick. You know, there's a cake in there where you don't really have to make a frosting. It's flavored whipped cream and berries is your frosting. Mm-hmm. So it makes it very fast. It's the only one I make when it's somebody's birthday because I'm busy.
Yeah, have to look that one up. Check that out. I did find that term that you used that I wanted to ask you about it. What is this nose-to-tail eating?
Oh, nose-to-tail eating. That phrase was coined by an Irish chef named Fergus Henderson. He's in England in a restaurant called St. John's. And he wrote a book called something like The Whole Beast, Nose to Tail Eating. And it's the idea that I just mentioned of getting the whole animal and then figuring out what to do with the short ribs and the tail and the whatever it is.
And every part.
In the old days when people supported themselves off the land, and everybody did, really, almost everybody, they had to know how to do that. And you know what? Those odd pieces are the best. They have the most flavor. Nothing against a good steak, but something like short ribs or chuck roast or you name it. I mean, there's something you can do with it.
So that's what nose-to-tail eating is.
You know, I even wrote a column about nose-to-tail vegetables, just riffing on that term. We learned from our chickens, if you can believe it, the broccoli leaves were delicious. Mm-hmm. And they liked them even better than kale leaves, which you're supposed to eat. But whoever ate broccoli leaves, so all of us at the farm started trying to cook with broccoli foliage. And it was delicious.
And what did you do?
The idea about greens, all the greens are a little different. Like something like Chinese cabbage, like baby pak choy, is such a tender green. You could either cook it stir-fried or completely raw in a salad. When you get into kale, well, I know there's a chef right here in Portland, Joshua McFadden, at Ava Jean's restaurant. He taught me how to make raw kale salad with hot pepper and parmesan and egg and all kinds of good things. So you can do an awful lot with raw greens. If you remove the rib of a Tuscan kale leaf, for instance. It's very tender. I think the thing I do most often with the tougher greens is, let's say I've had a cast iron skillet and I've made bacon or sausage in it, some sort of pork usually, and I still got this wonderful grease in there. I toss in the chopped greens, whether it's kale or chard or collard or spinach or whatever, and saute it, maybe cover it a little bit, maybe a little bit of water that you washed the leaves in. And it's just delicious that way. It flavors it. And the old way of cooking those greens is to boil it to death with a piece of salt pork. This is just a better way to do it. It keeps much more of the vitamins in.
And it's prettier.
And it's prettier. And I'm just very conscious of not throwing away nutrients. So like with beets, I try to do things like baked beets. I take each beet whole, unpeeled, and I wrap it in foil. And I put it in a covered casserole. And then I put it in an oven, medium oven, for like 3 hours. Then I just go away and forget about it. And I bring it out, take the foil off, and the skin just slips right off. But inside, it hasn't lost any moisture the way it would, and the red color is all still in there. It's all soft and sort of sweetened and intensified. And while it's so sort of warm, I'll slice it and mix it with balsamic vinegar and oil, and it's just the most delicious thing you've ever heard of. And it's so easy to do because you just stick it in there and ignore it.
I know. I always feel when I cook beets, I feel so sad about that, like, super dark purple water.
Yeah,
even when you steam it, I feel like you're losing a lot of that
even
into the water.
Even if you steam it, that's like, betalains. Those are the anthocyanins anthocyanins are another one. But betalains, anthocyanins, those red purpley things are water soluble. And it doesn't happen with peppers and carrots because those are lycopenes and carotenes that are oil soluble, which is why you don't have red water if you boil a pepper.
Is there something else that we should be talking about that you'd like to share with our audience?
I think people should not be afraid to garden. Oh, I have a black thumb. You know, everything is going to be eaten by pests. People should just get over that. Pests happen if you haven't done something quite right. And their way of saying, this plant was vulnerable. This plant needed to be taken care of a little differently. Its resistance was weakened.
Barbara, thank you so much for coming
into
KABU and being on the KABU Food Show.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
That was Barbara Damrosch, author of The Four Seasons Farm Gardener's Cookbook. You are listening to the KABU Food Show. I love it when art and food overlap. That's why it was a pleasure to sit down and talk with friends and collaborative artists, Nolan Kalish and Molly Sherman, who organized Farm School. Their most recent collaboration, The Old Apple Tree Project, is one that connects people with food, history, and place. We had a conversation about the inspiration for Farm School and the Old Apple Tree Project recorded at Wealth Underground Farm. A side note, Wealth Underground Farm is not only the home base of Farm School, it's also a small CSA farm that Nolan and I manage. Here is the conversation with Farm School.
My name is Nolan Kalish.
I'm Molly Sherman.
Yeah, and together we have a collaboration called Farm School.
So tell me a little bit about Farm School, kind of how it originated and what's the idea behind it.
Well, Farm School originated about 3 years ago when we were in graduate school together and came out of our own connections to realizing that we both had these strong interests in food and agriculture and documentation and relating those to our art practices. Mm-hmm. And also growing up, we both grew up in the rural Midwest, and we're really connected to the land there.
Yeah, we both have sort of deep connections to where we grew up in the rural setting, and sort of a lot of our work has to do with people's relationship to place and connecting to place, which is something that we had that experience growing up. So
you talked about the role of food, how you kind of had similar interest in food and agriculture. How does food play into your art?
Not all our projects deal directly with food, but sort of indirectly, because they're about a lot about place. But one project we do is called Grocery Stories, which started when we were artists in residence at New Seasons Market in Portland. And we were thinking a lot about the grocery store as a place where majority of the public interacts with food. And so there's a lot of potential there. And our project is that we interview farmers and growers who source to New Seasons. We go to the farms to do those interviews. And then we edit them down to short, like, audio pieces that are installed back in the store next to food items so that shoppers can encounter those stories when they're shopping and listening. So that's one project that deals with sort of making that connection to food system and making that being sort of transcribing that information from the farm to the store where the majority of the public is. We've had the opportunity to be on farms and see the reality of how food is grown and sort of have that education, but not everybody has that access. So the project's partially about bringing this information to a place where people can have access to it.
And so the reason why I have you guys here and we're talking is because of a more recent project that's similar in how it kind of connects folks to place and food. So let's talk a little bit about the Old Apple Tree project. If you want, could you give us a short introduction to the project?
Yeah. So the oldest apple tree in the Pacific Northwest is just 5 miles from downtown Portland. It's located near Fort Vancouver, and it dates back to 1826. And so we, after finding out about this tree, we developed a project around it where we took cuttings from the tree after talking to the Vancouver Urban Forestry Commission and Fort Vancouver, and then grafting those cuttings with 12 organizations and residents of Vancouver and Portland.
And then those descendant trees were then planted around the region, some in front yards, some at one at a public library, one at the Historical Society. They're sort of distributed equally around the area. And they're accompanied by a public plaque that gives information, says this is a descendant of the oldest apple tree in the Pacific Northwest, and it was planted by the Allen family in April of 2013. So that specific one, the Allen family, is in a front yard, so in southeast Portland. So you could, if you're walking in that neighborhood, you would see this bright blue plaque in someone's front yard. Part of the process of the project was to looking into the history that surrounded this one very old living tree, because 1826 was a really kind of loaded, dynamic time in this region's history. It was pre-Portland. It was even pre-settlement. The only European presence was Fort Vancouver in the area. So this cultivated apple was, in some ways, it was marked the beginning of Western agriculture in the region. And so it represents this really dynamic history with a lot of layers and perspectives. So part of the project was bringing that together and synthesizing it into a newspaper.
Yeah, we did a lot of research into the tree and reading old diary entries, learning about how the tree ended up being planted, where it's planted, which is a story that there was a man named Emilius Simpson that was traveling to Fort Vancouver from London, and before he left London, he went to a dinner party and ate an apple and some grapes, and those seeds ended up in the front pocket of his vest, and then he, you know, rediscovered them when he arrived to the West Coast here, and they were planted by a gardener. And so when that story comes out of a report that the archaeologist at Fort Vancouver did, Bob Cromwell. And so part of the newspaper was connecting to him, and he wrote a new piece for that publication.
And the tree has this amazing history of caretakers
over the years.
Yeah.
Which is one of the ways we found out about the tree in the first place, was through Larry McGraw.
Right. Yeah. And that's, there's an orchard, public orchard on Sauvie Island called the Pioneer Orchard. And that orchard was conceived and grafted and implemented by Larry McGraw, who was a pomologist in Portland, started the Home Orchard Society. And then he was also instrumental in saving the old apple tree when Highway 14 in Washington was coming through and threatening it. And so he helped save it, and the highway now skirts it by, you know, several yards, not much. The whole tree is surrounded by highways. But yeah,
and train and
trains, yeah, and airplanes. It's in a really abrasive sort of environment, making it all the more interesting, I think. And so that Larry McGraw led us to the old apple tree. But then, as we sort of started to investigate the history, it has had other caretakers previously, you know, all the way back. And its legacy has been pretty interesting, because it's always had this legacy of not about being on its last legs, not quite making it. There were journal entries 100 years ago.
1909, there's a man, A.A. Kornberg, and he was kind of a caretaker for the tree then, and he wrote about it being infested with bugs and not going to make it, totally on its last legs. And yeah.
100 years later, we're still saying that. Right. So
yeah, give a little bit of a description. I think the tree is really fascinating in and of itself, and I know there's photos in that publication. Mm-hmm. But give a little description of the tree.
Yeah.
It's hard to call a tree.
Even since we knew it, have known it, it's changed pretty dramatically. When we first visited it, it had a pretty large canopy. And then shortly after that, there was a windstorm that, and it was top heavy, you know, it still had fruit, and it's 186th year. Mm-hmm. It had some fruit, so it was pretty top heavy, and a big windstorm came and ended up putting a large crack down its trunk, which is already hollow, and so it suffered a pretty dramatic setback last fall.
Yeah.
And so then the arborist who cares for it did a pretty major heading cut on, gave it a, you know, pruned it back to send the energy back into its roots to hopefully save it. So it looks pretty sorry right now.
Mm-hmm. I just drove past it yesterday, though, and it's green and
lush.
Spring into summer, it's coming,
it's
growing.
It's crazy, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So
it's doubly fenced in, too. That's another part of, like, visiting this tree and seeing it having these two massive fences around it.
One, the original, like, decorative,
right,
sort of fence.
And then a chain link.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's yet to be seen what sort of the if it makes it next year, but it seems like it is going to.
I wish you guys could have a conversation with the guy who wrote the journal entry in 1909 about comparing it being on its last leg.
And he was one to kind of realize that this is already a really old tree, mm-hmm, to pay attention to, and was part of getting having a fence put around it, the first fence put around it too.
So let's talk about some of the descendants of the old apple tree. Mm-hmm. There's one in particular that is living across the street from the Portland Art Museum. Mm-hmm. Talk about mm-hmm. that and the relationship with this project and the art museum.
We ended up sitting down with the curator from the Native American Gallery in the Portland Art Museum and historian from the Oregon Historical Society, and having a conversation with them about this tree and kind of having these two viewpoints come together about this tree. And that ended up being, we transcribed that interview for the newspaper, and it was such a fruitful and energetic and interesting conversation that we designed a tour to happen between the two institutions on the night that we planted a tree at the Oregon Historical Society. Mm-hmm. And each leg of the tour was led by, Dina Dart Newton from the Portland Art Museum led one leg of the tour, and then Eliza Canty Jones from Oregon Historical Society led the other.
So the both people sort of related the history to a work in the museum and offered their own perspective from their own discipline on it. So it started to make visual that dynamic history that's around the tree. So that was, so that was sort of an extra project tacked on to this planting at the Historical Society.
That was part of a larger event called Shine a Light.
This sort of relates is that, you know, when we were starting this project, we wanted to be sensitive to the fact that one way of looking at these trees are, or the old apple tree, is that it's like a relic of colonization. And so we, you know, purposefully sought out native voices, prominent voices from the native community, to sort of get their opinion on the project and sort of what they thought about that. And we met with a man named Bob Ryan, who teaches in the Indigenous Studies Department at PSU, and he was really great and helpful, and he connected us to an organization called Wisdom of the Elders. And so we ended up planting a tree with them. They're in Southeast Portland, and they're a dynamic organization. They're just starting, but part of their organization is to educate Native community on Native plants and practices. And so the one apple tree is living there in the front area of their new garden. So that's pretty cool.
I want to kind of interject too. When you say an apple tree is now living in their front yard, what exactly does it look like? What is it?
That's a good point. So and that's been a really funny thing in the project, is that showing up with what some people refer to as twigs, but
they're about 12 inches long.
Uh-huh.
And look like a stick.
Yeah. And especially pre-planting,
a stick with tape on it.
Right.
Right.
So yeah, wounded stick. But the tape is the graft point, you know, where the union between the old apple tree and a rootstock. So you're basically taking your cutting, your scion wood, and grafting it onto a blank, an apple blank, that's proven a hardy rootstock, disease resistant, etc. And so that rootstock has just a few little tender roots. But literally within a month, the trees have all leafed out, some with significant branches.
Have shot up, you know, branches that double their size. It's been pretty exciting.
So the timing was, I mean, it's spring, so it was also thinking about that. Mm-hmm. The timing, planting the time correctly, and we got them in a really good time, and
sure,
the spring rain sort of watered them in, and all of them are doing really well.
How old is the apple tree, the old apple tree?
187.
So these twigs now that you're putting in the ground have 187 years of experience growing, so yeah. They're just, they know what to do.
Yeah.
And in harsh conditions, too.
Yeah, right.
Adverse, yeah. So, and we've now visited all the trees, mm-hmm. After at least a month after their planting, and checked on them, and they're all doing really well.
Right. So there's the Oregon Historical Society tree, Wisdom of the Elders, Sabin Community Orchard in Northeast, Capitol Hill Library in Southwest,
mm-hmm. Harvest Homes, assisted living home, where there's also an intergenerational preschool there. They have a tree that's in St. John's area. We planted one here on the farm, Wealth Underground Farm.
Three front yards in Vancouver, and then a couple front yards in Portland.
Mm-hmm. So the legacy of this tree is going to live on.
Yeah, and the idea, too, is that now there are 12 more caretakers.
Sure.
And that joins the list of the caretakers that it's had for its history.
Well, Molly Nolan, thank you so much for talking with me.
Sure.
Thanks.
You're listening to the KBOO Food Show. To learn more about Farm School, you can visit their website at farmschool.tumblr.com. You can find copies of the Old Apple Tree Project publication at the Oregon Historical Society. It's now the season for farmers markets. The variety of fruit and produce increases from week to week as spring transitions into summer. One of the best places to get the freshest food directly from the growers is the farmers market. We have in the studio a few market managers from the Portland area. Jarrett Foster manages the Portland Farmers Market, Laura Conroy manages the Hillsboro Farmers Market, and Bill Blank manages the Scappoose Farmers Market. Jarrett, Laura, and Bill, welcome to the food show.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So it seems like every farmers market has its own personality. Could you each describe the farmers markets you manage?
Sure. I'll go first. This is Jarrett from Portland Farmers Market. Portland Farmers Market is, we have our Saturday Farmers Market at PSU, but we also manage 8 other markets in Portland. So actually, as of Monday of this week, we have a market open every day of the week except Tuesday. Portland Farmers Market is a nonprofit organization that manages those 8 markets in Portland. And this is our 22nd year. The Farmers Market was founded in 1992.
Awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, Scappoose Farmers Market is probably the opposite of the Portland Farmers Market, as far as we are a small rural market just outside the Portland area, only about a half a mile, actually. About 30 minutes away. But we are all volunteer. We've been our market now for going into our 11th year. And the people that come there are from the local area as well as maybe from the northern part of Portland. We're more competitors somewhat, I guess, with St. John's, only because we're both Saturday markets. But we still get along. It's not a problem, you know.
And good morning. This is Laura with Hillsboro Farmers Market. And like Portland Farmers Market, our nonprofit organization operates 5 markets this year in the Hillsboro area. We have our popular Saturday market, which is in historic downtown Hillsboro. It is the place to be if you have small children. They love the fountain. They love our Market Sprouts program. They love our Trek Garden program. And we just celebrated our 30th anniversary last year, so 31 years this year. Then we have our Orenco Sunday Market. It's our sleep-in market. So the hours are 10 to 2. And then we have our Wednesday night Tannisbourne Market, which is a global cuisine and culture market. And we run not only farmers and produce and such, but also global cuisine and culture. So there's actually an Indian night tonight that's happening. And then we are
tonight,
under...
Tonight, did you say?
Yeah, tonight at the Tannisbourne Farmers Market. There'll be Bollywood moves.
What time is that?
From 4 to 7 tonight. And then we're under contract with 2 hospitals in the area to provide markets to their employees.
And I guess I can speak to the St. John's Farmers Market. So we're also a Saturday market, as Bill mentioned, and it's kind of a family community market. It's more of an event each week than anything, although we do. I mean, we have great producers, great growers there, but we have a lot of music and activities for kids. We actually have a puppet show coming up this next week that's really exciting. So, but it's definitely a kind of a community sort of scene. It's a place to go on a Saturday. So it seems like more and more farmers markets popping up. And I know Portland is a place where farmers markets, where they can work. But I want to ask if you guys feel like we're kind of reaching a saturation point, or if, you know, farmers markets can keep on, if we can have more and more and reach more people. So what are your thoughts on the saturation of farmers markets in Portland?
This is Jared. I would speak to that and say that there's a one of the added benefits of markets having been so popular in Portland is that there are a lot more options outside of farmers market for local produce. I think a lot of local retailers have sort of they have responded to that customer demand and started bringing in local products into their real estate retail stores, which is wonderful. What farmers markets provide, though, however, is still some of that niche marketing, where we actually have some of the absolute first season things that are going to be in such small quantities that any of the retailers wouldn't actually be able to get their hands on Sun Gold tomatoes today, even though they're ripe. Just a couple of cases of them have made it to the farmers market. So farmers markets are still a really special place to go. Within that is, you know, with many of the neighborhoods in Portland have a retailer in them that has some local products in it, but we also feel that a farmers market has certainly a place in those neighborhoods. And we're still actually seeing this year, we're actually seeing more customers return to our markets for that kind of specialty item. We also, part of what we pride ourselves on is that we're a community gathering place. So it's certainly going to be a lot more fun to go to the farmers market than it ever would to go to any grocery store, no matter what they're carrying. As far as Portland Farmers Market proper, our nonprofit, we are not looking to add new markets right now. We're looking at some different other options as far as getting local products into the local marketplace. One thing that's kind of exciting is today we've got our market bike, which is called the Produce Peddler, up at Pioneer Courthouse Square, which is where PFM is actually doing some marketing of local berries, cherries, and flowers off of the market bike.
I don't think I've seen the market bike. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. It's a cargo bike that's set up. It's got a 3x6 sort of cargo truck on the front of it. It's a trike, and we actually have it set up with a canopy on it. And it's basically situated so that it can market produce off of it. And we sell it on behalf of our growers that participate at the markets nearby. So it's actually at Pioneer Courthouse Square for sales from 11 to 2 on Mondays and Wednesdays for June and July. So you can check us out there. And then it'll be at like community events like Sunday Parkways. You'll see it wherever Portland Farmers Market is doing some tabling to bring people into the community. So it's kind of a fun thing. I've been having a ton of fun with it.
Yeah, another thing too I think I'd like to mention is that small farmers markets as well bring other aspects to the community. We refer to ours as the front porch of our community because that's where people go. They have a way of getting together. They meet people that they've met all during the week. Last Saturday, they haven't seen them in a while. They come back. They meet them. And we're a family oriented sort of a market. But now with markets, a lot of them are going with CSAs or community supported agriculture. And they use that as a site for pickups and things like that. Even some of our farmers are starting to do that now. So it's a process where people can come, not only just to meet each other, but pick up even vegetables and fruits and things like that, besides just buying directly from a vendor there, but from the farmer that might be bringing a large box or whatever. So that's a new aspect to a lot of markets. More and more people are starting to see that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and out in Washington County, so this is Laura with Hillsborough, we have kind of a loose coalition of market managers out there, the Beaverton Farmers Market, Tigard, Forest Grove, and North Plains, and we collaborate quite a bit. We deliver this Market Sprouts program, which is sponsored by our friends at New Seasons. And so we have a lot of opportunity to talk about this. And the consensus is that Washington County is growing. And it's this lovely combination of rural farms and fields and an exploding urban population, an exploding diverse urban population. And there doesn't seem to be any limit on markets. One of the limits that, if there was any limit, is that we do have some food deserts, which is incredible given that we're in such a fertile county. And one of the ways that we're trying to get at that is at Hillsborough Farmers Market is with a mobile market, which is a pilot program this year and modeled off of some mobile market setups in around the country, including the Gorge Grown Market. And sort of like your berry bike, Jarrett, we take produce from our vendors and farmers and we take it into areas, affordable housing complexes and other areas that maybe aren't quite ready to have their own community market yet, which takes a lot of work and a lot of infrastructure. But their communities are desperate for that fresh produce. And we're taking it into them and welcoming anyone that wants to join to kind of set up alongside of us. So not out in Washington County, we're not seeing saturation yet.
So you spoke to kind of affordability a little bit, and it seems like that there's a mindset that farmers markets, like shopping for organic food in general, is more expensive and caters to those who are more affluent. So what are farmers markets doing to try to promote accessibility and affordability?
Well, many of the farmers markets have matching programs. And actually, today, with me and going out into outlets around the Tri-County area, will be a pamphlet called Farmers Markets Are for Everyone. This was produced as part of the Farmers Market Fund, which is a foundation set up to help assist with access, low-income access to markets. And it's a brochure that describes all of the markets in the area, and I shouldn't say just Tri-County, it extends a little bit further south, that have matching programs. So if someone has a SNAP card, they can come to these markets and use their SNAP card, and many of these markets will also give them an extra few tokens to spend at the markets. Many of the markets also do programming specifically for low-income and WIC shoppers, helping them stretch that dollar just a little further. And I'll let anybody else chime in
here. How do you access that? Like if you come to the market and you have a SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, you go to the main information desk and get tokens? How does that work?
Yep, you've got it.
Okay.
You come to the information booth, you swipe your Oregon Trail card, and we give you wooden nickels. And all the markets have their own wooden nickels. And then the vendors, you can use those with the vendors, with the produce vendors. And they come in different denominations depending on what market you go to. At Hillsborough Farmers Markets, we issue them in $1 denominations. And we have a $5 match, up to a $5 match. So if you come to the market and withdraw $10 in your SNAP benefit, then we'll match it up to $5.
So we've got about a minute and a half left. And I wanted to get to this. There's a... Yeah, no, time flies when you're having fun. But there's this campaign that's going on right now, and I want to hear more about that, the campaign to promote farmers markets in Oregon.
Sure. Portland Farmers Market was awarded a specialty crop grant from the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and what we have is an advertising campaign where we collaborated with a number of farmers markets all throughout the region, all down through the Willamette Valley, actually. It's called In Local We Love. We do have a website, inlocalwelove.com. And there's actually, it's an advertising campaign, so it actually has billboards. And what it's trying to do, billboards, etc., is trying to appeal to shoppers that aren't currently shopping at farmers markets. There tends to be a lot of marketing to the choir, so to speak, as far as farmers markets, people that are already buying locally and interested. What's really difficult to get to historically has been people that aren't ready, already built in, ready to buy at farmers markets. So this In Local We Love campaign is set up to attract some of those people that may not already be shopping in that vein, already shopping at farmers markets. We're trying to attract more, and that's it's a much larger initiative than any sort of the grassroots marketing that farmers markets typically have done.
Great. Well, I want to thank you guys so much for being here. I want one more chance to kind of go around and say where our listeners can find you.
Scappoose Farmers Markets on Saturdays between the hours of 9 and 2. We're open all the way to the end of September. And that's about where you'll find us every year.
Are you right on
We're right on Highway 30, off of Highway 30, about a block. You can see us as you're traveling to the north end of town. We're right behind City Hall there in the parking lot.
Portland Farmers Market has, like I mentioned, a market every day of the week but Tuesday. So we're Saturday at PSU, Wednesday at Shemansky Park downtown, Monday Pioneer Courthouse Square, Sunday King. Two markets on Thursday, one at Southeast 20th and Salmon, and one at Northeast 19th and Everett. And our newest market is Friday at Kenton, which is right on Denver in Kenton in North Portland.
And a partridge in a pear tree. people can go to our website, www.hillsboroughmarkets.org, www.hillsboroughmarkets.org, for our five market locations. We'd love to have you.
Great. Thank you so much. Jared, yeah, Laura, and Bill, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And when you get a chance to pick up this Farmers Markets Are for Everyone brochure, it lists a whole page of farmers markets, 20, 35 farmer markets in the Portland area. Thanks for tuning in to the KBOO Food Show. We want to thank all of our guests, Barbara Damrush,
Nolan
Janet,
and Molly from Farm
yeah,
School.
Yeah, Jared, Laura, and Bill, and Brian QTN. Once again, this is Brian QTN singing, and he will be at the People's Farmers Market this afternoon.
Tune in.
Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, because you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd Avenue, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 11:59. Coming up at 12 o'clock is Jazz Lives with your host, Nick Geffro.
This is KBOO Headline News at noon for June 19th, 2013.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that juries must have the final say in determining mandatory minimum sentences in criminal trials. On Monday, the court voted 5-4 to overturn the sentencing of a Virginia man convicted of robbery and firearm possession. The jury in this case determined that the accomplice in the crime had not threatened with a weapon, but the judge disagreed. The ruling determined that the judge used a lower standard of proof in making his determination, which raised the defendant's minimum prison term from 5 to 7 years.
A controversial Arizona voter ID law requiring prospective voters to prove their citizenship before registering has been struck down by a 7-2 Supreme Court decision. The ACLU declared the court's decision a victory. The Arizona law in question went beyond federal policies by requiring applicants to provide proof of citizenship when they register to vote. Civil rights groups said that the law was an effort to prevent legal immigrants from voting. Groups in favor of the law insist that it reduced voter fraud, even though no instances of voter fraud had been documented in the state.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has announced that there is no indication that genetically modified wheat has spread beyond the original source found in an Oregon field last month. Genetically modified wheat has never been approved for U.S. farming. The wheat that was discovered 2 weeks ago was the same strain that was tested by Monsanto a decade ago.